Before we start, just a quick reminder, please make sure you're subscribed to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and please leave us a review. It really helps other people discover the show. All right, let's get to it. Hello, and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
And this is an emergency edition of our Powerhouse Politics podcast. We usually come to you later in the week, but Rick, too much happening. We felt a need to get to our listeners on three major storylines converging right now. Of course, we have the...
Wait, first, John, are you calm? I want to make sure you're calm before we say calm down.
I'm trying. Hunter Walker, our friend at Yahoo, showed me a sign they had made, the keep calm and carry on.
They've
redone it to keep calm, John Carl.
So, oh, good. Okay, good. Just making sure.
I'm trying to keep calm.
White House request.
But three major storylines, really. First of all, we have the upcoming vote on health care. Really can't overstate the importance of this to the Trump agenda and his first real legislative test. Obviously, we have the Russia investigation and the bombshell that we heard on Monday from James Comey that he is investigating possible links between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And then, of course, what normally would be the lead story everywhere, the confirmation hearing for what would be Justice Neil Gorsuch.
And the interesting thing to me is how these stories are sometimes related and sometimes not related at all. So you have these bombshells that you mentioned. The director of the FBI saying no evidence for the Trump tweets. In addition to that, you have this amazing statement that the Trump administration or the Trump campaign under investigation. And then separate than that, you've got members of Congress that are being told basically, trust us. Trust our word in the Trump White House on the health care bill because it can't be the last word.
Credibility is a
string that you have to carry forward right there. And one question is, are they going to make good on all of these things? And then you have Gorsuch, which to me is almost happening in an alternate Washington reality. It is so normal. And he is so nice. And the members of Congress are playing it just like they always play these confirmation hearings that we've seen for so many years. It seems to not be happening in Trump's Washington, which I guess is a good thing for the White House because it seems like that is on track. So you have all of this chaos swirling. And then the thing that you traditionally think would be a big showdown, major battle lines, all the money being spent and all of the pressure being brought to bear, that has been quiet. And everything else is what's swirling around.
By the way, we have a really special guest on this emergency edition of the Powerhouse Politics podcast, somebody who can actually talk to us about all three of these things, but somebody who has been immersed in the Gorsuch confirmation hearings now entering in day two, a friend of the podcast, we know a loyal listener of the podcast, frequent contributor to the podcast, a big fan of yours, Rick Klein, I know.
That's not true.
And somebody that we certainly admire, Terry Moran. ABC's chief guru, foreign correspondent,
Supreme Court
guy, former White House correspondent. I mean, I don't know what else can we say about the guy.
Good friend of the podcast is good because the rest of it you're laying on a little thick here, but I'm glad to be here. This is among the hats I wear, the Supreme Court thing. I discover how much I love it every time I come back to it. This day and a half of Gorsuch has been, to me, because I'm a geek for this stuff, fascinating to watch. It's been good stuff.
So, Justice Moran, we want to get to you on that. But before we dive into the Gorsuch hearing, I want to get to the FBI investigation into the links, possible links between the Trump campaign and Russia. And specifically, as somebody who spends most of his time these days for us in London, we had an amazing moment in the hearing with Rogers and Comey on this issue of what the White House said about possible links between British intelligence and the alleged wiretapping of Trump Tower. You saw Admiral Rogers quite angrily, at least I interpreted it as being quite angry, in saying that he agreed that Sean Spicer reading this allegation that basically the Brits did the dirty work for Obama as being outrageous. What has been the impact? Clearly, they're worried that this is actually potentially hurting our relationship with the Brits.
it has damaged that closest alliance in the world, even closer than Canada or Israel. The alliance with the United Kingdom, with Great Britain, is really one of the linchpins of American policy for 70 years and more. And they're bewildered and furious. And even more than that, they are now, I would say, joining at this point. Look, it's early days still in the Trump administration, but the feeling one gets listening to British officials, officials from Germany and other European allies is, you know what, this is a very different United States. We have to kind of go our own way on some of these things. We've got to figure out how we're going to accomplish our security interests, certainly our trade interests, regional interests in the Middle East and elsewhere, without the leadership of the United States, because we don't know what he's trying to do. We don't entirely agree with it on many things, and we don't even really trust that White House. This is more than just a tiff. It's more than just they got really angry at this sloppy, baseless insult that Sean Spicer threw out at a press briefing that apparently can be traced back to literally a Kremlin-backed fake news website. So, you know, that's just perfect. But it's actually now feeding into what is becoming a considered policy direction that Europe is beginning to take, which is a sense that U.S. leadership is not part of, not the primary part of our foreign policy in these areas. And that could have long-term significance.
And just to recap exactly what happened, Sean Spicer went on that last Thursday, went on that 8-minute-long diatribe or, you know, a monologue where he read from all the various news reports, commentary, anything that mentioned anything about surveillance of the Trump Tower or of Trump associates. And one of the things he read was Judge Andrew Napolitano, a Fox News legal analyst, saying that, that it was the Brits that did it on behalf of Barack Obama. And then we heard the president standing next to Angela Merkel say, look, that was just a Fox News report. Ask Fox. And it was an amazing thing because less than an hour after he said that, you saw Shep Smith go on Fox News and say, no.
Fox answered.
We have zero evidence that happened. That was, you know, basically that was one guy that went rogue. Fox News has no information that happened. And then we had, and this is what I want to ask you about, Terry. We had the reports that the White House called the British ambassador to apologize and to promise that the allegation would not be repeated. But almost immediately after those reports came out, the White House said there was no apology. So can you interpret what happened? I mean, the British seemed to think that they got an apology.
They did, in fact. That morning, I was in London. I'd flown here for the hearings. And reporters were told off camera by Downing Street that the United States, that Spicer and General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, had apologized and promised that this wouldn't happen again because the British intelligence services were livid, absolutely livid. It made them look like piratical, lawless, you know, criminals rummaging through Americans' election and personal information when they do not do that, period, full stop. And there are very severe and significant barriers erected against that as part of really one of the keystones of American global intelligence, the Five Eyes agreement among the America's closest allies in sharing intelligence. Part of that agreement includes how we don't cooperate. And GCHQ, the British Intelligence Service, was just livid that this allegation, which was completely errant nonsense, they called it in very British terms, that it would damage their credibility, that they don't do stuff like that. And so they were very, very angry. And so they were proudly, and happily called up reporters and brought reporters in and told them now there's been an apology, won't do it again. And then because for whatever reason, this White House, from the president right on down, has this fetish about not apologizing. Within an hour, we were hearing again from Downing Street about the same matter. They were telling us that, GCHQ and the intelligence services were denying it. And then they wouldn't say the word apology. And I was like, well, was there an apology or not? And GCHQ is denying that this happened. We are now all squared away and we will move forward. I said, well, did they apologize or not? And they literally just had to drop that aspect from their brief because real men don't apologize or something. And by the way, just a footnote on that, every real man I've ever met, including the man who taught me how to be a man, and most of it, right, your father teaches you how to be a man. What does your dad tell you as a young man? He says, if you don't have the facts to back up what you say, don't say it. And if you make a mistake, apologize. That's real manhood, I think, to most people. But for some reason, this White House won't ever apologize, and you ended up in this bizarre morning, which was worse than just an inconvenience. It was another level of humiliation on our closest ally in the world. So you can imagine how does that impact cooperation on anti-terror efforts,
yeah,
on the efforts against Russia, which already they don't really trust this administration on. Because Russia is not just meddling in American elections. Obviously, they've been meddling in Europe for about 500 years.
And Terry, of course, this isn't the only area where the president didn't apologize this week. You had the director of the FBI say no evidence behind the tweets. John pushed Sean Spicer on it, and no, they're not ready to concede on that. And that brings me, Terry, I mean, you mentioned flying all the way over here, but actually ABC News flew you over here and then deposited you in this time machine of a Supreme Court hearing. And you went back to another time where things were pretty predictable, at least to my mind. It seems like you guys are in a bubble in that hearing room right now, and you've been there for so much of it. Has this tense atmosphere where you have the director of the FBI saying the president lied, you have the director of the FBI confirming an investigation, you have this scramble, a lobbying push by the president on his first and biggest legislative priority, the arm twisting going on. Does any of that spill over into that hearing room with Judge Gorsuch?
It does. And I like the description of this as being a kind of a time machine bubble. It's kind of nice. It is. We're listening to senators question earnestly, you know, from their conservative or liberal or partisan backgrounds, but with earnestness about constitutional issues and stuff like that. And that has been very, very gratifying. But what you're talking about is the weather around us, and it has blown into this hearing room a couple of times. Once
the mood music is the, as Mike Allen would say.
The mood music, exactly. It's definitely in there. For one thing, sometimes quite sharply, Judge Gorsuch, the nominee, is directly questioned about the FBI investigation into the alleged potential links between the Trump campaign and Russia, and so in that way it comes in. But in other ways, one line of questioning that Democrats and Republicans have pursued is how independent can you tell us? Can you guarantee that you will be independent of this president who has nominated you? Can you stand up to a president who may, as Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat of Connecticut, put it yesterday, you know, be involved in a criminal investigation that may get to the Supreme Court, as the Nixon investigation did? So sometimes the crazy events and the in some ways desperate urgency of events outside those other things that you're talking about outside this hearing room seep in. But I am happy to report that most of these long hours in here are spent on sometimes difficult but often quite meaningful constitutional and statutory and personal discussions. Just like, boy, I've been covering these things. I had said the second week I was on my first newspaper job. I covered the Bork nomination, so I think I'm going to, at some point, have covered the nominations of every single one of the Supreme Court. I'm getting there. And it feels like, and not the Bork one or the Thomas one, but it feels like a normal Supreme Court nomination.
We've heard Marbury versus Madison and Roe v. Wade, and now even Chevron, we remember those things. So let's talk about Judge Gorsuch, because to my mind, you used the word earnest in the questioning. The word that springs to my mind about Judge Gorsuch is earnest. I also think he's coming across, to my mind, my observation, want yours on this, compassionate, human, humorous at times. He's joking around with some of these senators. Yes, there's been tense moments, but how is he handling this rather extraordinary moment in Washington?
Well, we see he's handling it very well, and I think it would take a remarkable effort by Democrats or something very surprising coming out to generate enough public opinion to block his nomination. He's on his way, it seems to me, just after a day and a half of this. Now, that could change. But we've seen two Judge Gorsuches. One is the one that you're describing, this calmly poised, confident person who is unafraid to share his heart in talking about his family, but also in talking about the law, how much he loves what he does and reveres certain mentors in the law, and how much he cares for the plaintiffs that come before him, even. And that is, it's winning, because it does seem quite humane and good. The other issue, though, that's come out is he's under questioning for the first time, half an hour at a time, 30 minutes at a time, by Democrat, then Republican, then Democrat, Republican, Democrat. So under the Democrats, he's got a face for 30 minutes. Sometimes, you know, none of it has been mean-spirited, but tough questioning, certainly by Senator Durbin of Illinois. And then you get a sense, this is not a man who's used to being challenged. He gets a little testy. It seems like he's a guy who you know, does not suffer fools lightly, and it's come out in ways that are probably not that great for him with senators, although he's never going to have really any kind of anything to do with them again if he gets confirmed. But it's interesting to see that, and maybe every nominee at some point in this process just wants to stand up and Jack Nicholson them all. You know, you can't handle the truth. But I think we've seen a side where he's a little less patient and a little testy and almost a little conceited, I think, has come out. And, you know, he's a guy who's had amazing success his whole life. He's entitled to it. But as a judge, that's the one thing where I'm thinking one of those Democrats is thinking, I can get him to snap maybe.
So how is he handling the big question about how he would face Trump, and if something comes before him, whether it's something related to a criminal case or something related to the use of executive power, how convincing is he in saying? I know the line he used was, "There no man is above the law." Is it convincing?
It is convincing, in part because he's not close to Trump at all. He doesn't know him at all. I met him once in the interview, and that's it. And so I don't think he's got any specific loyalty to Trump. However, as far as executive power is concerned, you know, he was a lawyer in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration. He helped craft some of the positions around the whole Guantanamo issue, the maximal exercise of presidential authority that administration was trying to affect down in Guantanamo. You know, we grab these people around the world, we put them in cages in this place that's not in the United States, and we are saying no court can review us over there. And once the court said, well, yes, we can, well, okay, they don't need any kind of habeas corpus. They don't really need full legal rights. And the court came back and said, yes, they do. So in that conflict, he took the president's side. That was what he was paid to do. So it's probable that he has a healthy sense of presidential authority, and that will be important. When the immigration ban comes before the court, he might be on it, and it will. The travel ban is likely to come before the court. And then we'll see. I don't think it'll be personal to Trump. I don't think he has personal loyalty to Trump, but I think he's likely to be, along with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito and some of the others, very strong for executive authority, for the power of the presidency.
And Terry, I want to get you back in the room real quick, but your take on how the Democrats are handling it, because it seems to me like they don't have a settled strategy. So the question is Gorsuch that good that he's overcoming it, or are the other stories that good for the Democrats, they just rather focus somewhere else?
I've been quite surprised, Rick, that they haven't had any kind of strategy, even if they aren't going to go to the mat on this one. And they may not want to, because, you know, you could get somebody far worse. Lindsey Graham said he didn't think Trump would pick a good nominee. He wasn't a Trump fan. Or because they're saving their real opposition for the next vacancy, which would perhaps be if Justice Kennedy retires, and then that would really be a war for the court, and the Democrats would go all out on that. But you'd think they'd have some kind of game plan here, at least to establish, say, that the seat is stolen, right? The whole stolen seat argument that the Democratic base is very engaged with, this, that Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to fill this seat, you know, didn't even get a hearing. You know, people would think that we've heard it mentioned, but not in any consistent or even very effective way, I would say. A couple of moments, but not much. And then it's been scattershot otherwise. Oh, you're a friend of corporations instead of working men and women. Oh, you know, do you really believe in individual rights? And so I've been surprised at that, and I think it's a missed opportunity to put some markers down, both for this nominee. One of the things that these hearings do, it's a conversation between the person who's going to be on the court and the Congress, and the only first and only conversation they're going to have. And so these senators get a chance to say, care about this when you get to the court. But they're not even doing that. It has been feckless, I would say. There's been some good questioning. Some of the senators seem quite prepared. I said Durbin did quite well, but I've just been surprised there's no game plan. He's going to likely get through, and I don't see that they set the table for any future action.
So, Terry, we're going to let you get back in there, but one very quick answer, if you don't mind. We'll put you on the spot. How many votes does he get for his confirmation?
Well, you know, after yesterday with the lovely statement he made, so poised and polished and well-written, I said, you know, he can probably get to 60. But now I kind of look at them today, and they're doing enough dinging and danging, and the Democrats are so hopping mad about this. I'm going to say he's going to get 56, 57 votes, but they won't filibuster.
Okay, there you go. Terry Moran. we'll let you get back. I see it looks like Ted Cruz is questioning him now, so we'll let you – we'll see what Justice Cruz has to say.
Exactly.
This is a tough one. Thanks, Terry.
All right. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks, guys.
So, Rick, the other thing we have to talk about before we draw this emergency podcast to a close is the healthcare vote, which we've been tracking very carefully. Obviously, the big test. I've been more bullish that the White House would succeed. You've been more bearish on their chances. Where are you now, whether or not it passes in the House on Thursday?
I'm sticking with failure. Either they delay it or they actually lose a vote. I think more likely a delay, and we're talking about it next week. I mean, the prospect of actually losing on the floor is unlikely, ultimately. But you can pull, you can delay, you can find excuses for it. Partly because I'm all in on this bet, but I think more importantly, you have a true ideological standoff right now. And you have some of the highest profile outside groups like Heritage, like Club for Growth, saying this is a no. And you have this pretty overt threat from the President of the United States. Maybe deliver with a smile, maybe not.
Yeah, I asked Spicer directly, will those who vote against this be held responsible by the President? Will they pay a price?
And the answer?
His answer was yes. He left it, you know, whether or not the President himself is the one exacting that price, but they will pay a price, he said, because they've promised to do this, and their constituents will hold them accountable.
And behind closed doors as well, Mark Meadows, hey, I'm coming for you. A little bit of a smile there, but obviously they know that this has some teeth. Now, the Freedom Caucus has said they're not going to make this an official position, so they're freeing up their members. But, man, there's a lot of skepticism. And this is the test of Trump's pull right here. Trump is very popular in a lot of these members' districts, very popular with the base of Republicans, but not popular nationally. Do they buck him on this, hoping to either get a different deal, a better deal? If not, the flip side is the Trump-Ryan team of rivals that the two of them represent, uniting the different wings of the party. That is a formidable presence. And on one level, winning in the House, so what? That's easy. On another level, they were counted out on this one a long time ago. It would be quite an achievement for them to turn it around.
Yeah, even though they passed some 40 times various
it's
forms
different when
of,
it's real. It's totally, but that's exactly it. It's different when you're actually talking about legislation that impacts people's lives. It was passed in this hypothetical fantasy land. Wouldn't it be nice? President Obama wasn't going to sign it. It's real now, and they've pushed this, and if they're able to get it done, it would be a remarkable legislative achievement. I'm still betting on no.
Okay, so I you're wrong, but that's okay. I think it's interesting that the White House has put this in such stark terms, explicitly today, Spicer was saying that this impacts all the rest of the agenda that they want to do this year.
It's like they're leading to entice people. Hey, if you want to do tax reform, right?
You got to do this if you want to get through to your budget stuff, you want to get through to tax reform, if you want to get through to infrastructure, all the things that they want to do, they've got to have their first victory. This should be the relatively easy one. It's the one they all campaigned on. But I agree it's going to be a very tough vote. I think that because they have defined the stakes so starkly, because the president is so vested in this, they will get it passed in the House on Thursday. But I will also tell you this, that you talked to the White House, and I don't think that they have any idea how they will get victory in the Senate on this. I think that they are entirely focused on getting this through the House. And I think that it's going to be a battle royale. What they are counting on is that the calculus suddenly changes. For those senators like Tom Cotton, who came out again today, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Rob Portman, you've got a lot more senators than they can afford to lose that have said that they are uncomfortable with this bill, they are not in favor of it in its current form. What the White House is calculating is that those senators are trying to change it in the House. They are trying to affect the outcome in the House. If it passes the House, then you have a real choice to in the Senate. These Republicans either have to support doing this, what many of them see as a half measure, or doing nothing, which would be leaving Obamacare in place.
And again, it come back to where we started with the linkage between these major storylines. One observation I was struck by in the hearings with Comey on Monday, the president of the United States has a lot of defenders still, and there's a lot of Republican members of Congress that went out of their way during a very rough day for the White House to put on the record the White House preferred version of events, make that investigation about leaks and not about the president's unfounded accusations and not about Russian connections. And that's the kind of party loyalty that the president of the United States is now drawing on
party
in trying
loyalty
to get health care
on an issue
through.
Where he doesn't like deserve party loyalty. I mean, this is like, I mean, he made these
right.
these allegations that none of them think are true, but they've played along with the idea of diverting away from it
In that context, healthcare should be easy.
Yes.
That's the least that you could get done because they all campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare.
Which is why you're wrong on your prediction that it will fail in the House. Right. But we'll talk. We'll be back with our regularly scheduled podcast. Why don't we make a deal that we will do it after the vote?
After the vote, deal.
Now, if you're right and the vote doesn't happen, maybe we'll never be another podcast.
Maybe not, John. Somehow I think you'll forget whatever prediction you made depending on the circumstance anyway.
Okay, anyway, that is it for this emergency edition of the Powerhouse Politics Podcast. David Ryan, our executive – he's executive producer now, right? Isn't he?
Let's give him
yeah, executive producer. We thank him, and we thank Terry Moran for joining us as well. Avery Miller off on vacation but still supporting the podcast. Thank you for listening. Arlette, everybody. We'll see you next week.